You've reached the Union and Metro Street podcast, where we discuss the San Diego music scene of the late 80s and all of the 90s, from the shows we worked and the shows we played at Soma Live. Here we go.
So we got a special guest with us that we haven't seen in a long time. You introduce
long
yourself.
Time, yeah. What's up? I'm Pat Kim. Go by PK or Pat, you know. Former bass player for Sprung Monkey, Unwritten Law, you know. I'm just glad to be here, guys. It's been a really long time.
It's been too long.
Like, very long time.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to remember the last time I saw you. You were probably playing in Unwritten Law.
I actually have a funny story. Do you remember, like, when I was in Unwritten Law, and I feel like one of the last times I saw you, Jer, was when we were at that house we were recording, and you brought Tobin before Papa Roach broke.
They were in the studio at NRG, and they were staying at the Oak Ridge.
Yeah, and then I remember you brought Tobin to that house and did the introduction. We're like, Papa Roach, who's that?
You guys were writing the
Elva, I believe. Yep. Yeah, they put us in that house in Hollywood. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah, that's the longest time ago.
Yeah, it was.
Uh-huh. Well, I didn't even realize any of that until I started doing research earlier.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking at everything that you did with Unwritten Law.
Right.
I mean, holy shit. You guys were busy.
Yeah, man. That was really a crazy little moment, man, for sure. So.
But going back to... Let's go back to the very roots. Because, again, as Jerry and I were talking earlier, you and John...
Yes.
Pebsworth.
Yeah, so we all know John Pebsworth, Buck 09 singer, you know?
Yeah.
So he and I basically went to junior high school and high school together.
Oh, okay.
And that's how we formed, my first punk band I was ever in was with John. We were called Labeled Victims, you know?
Yeah.
And it was, you know, we're friends then, and then, like, you know, it was all about punk rock for us. And then, you know, one night, I kind of remember it was at, like, a house party, and we're like all of a sudden like, hey, we should start a band. But, you know, I wasn't even playing an instrument back then, really, you know. And then we kind of did it, and it's kind of the seed was planted from that moment, you know.
And what year was this?
Oh, so I think I was like 15, 16. So high school, what is that, 88 maybe? Because I graduated 89, so it was like... Somewhere, right, maybe 87, 88, I think.
Okay.
You know, that would be the time frame, I think.
So. Wow. It's just weird how you and John came down down to San Diego.
Well, the thing is, you know, so once again, we went to high school together, and we did the label victims thing, but I ended up in San Diego because after high school, I went to San Diego State. That's the reason why I came to San Diego, was to go to State. And John... At that time, you know, was like, I ain't got nothing going on in L.A. either. So he ended up moving with me, and, you know, we got an apartment together.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, yeah. So we moved to San Diego together. That's how it all started, man.
I find that so bizarre, because two different bands, completely different styles, yet there's, like, the connection.
You know, even crazier on top of that was John was actually... the first, I'm not going to say official, but like he sang, like, you know, when I first joined Sprung Monkey, you know, we didn't have a singer then. So he was doing some stuff with Sprung in the very beginning, before we even sprung, even when we, you know, because I found the Sprung Monkey guys through the Reader.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Reader.
Yeah.
That's how you got into the band.
So that's how John found the Buck 09 guys.
Buck 09, yeah. So, you know, I've been with John through all his other bands even before Buck 09. He was in a band called Mind's Eye.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know.
I remember them because I tried out for them.
For Mind's Eye?
Yeah, but I was too... Oh, crap, I can't remember now. But they didn't like me for whatever. I think I was too punk for the band
Because they were like a little more on the metal side.
I was trying to do my best Waddy impressions that I ended up doing and Poor and everything else. But so... Then when John ended up, you know, I booked him, Mind's Eye.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, dude, wait a minute, I was supposed to be in that fucking band. I have some pictures, actually, but, you know, just that is just, that's, I'm so just bewildered by how this town came out of literally nothing.
Yeah.
And just grew because certain players. So let's jump right into, so Sprung Monkey, how did Sprung start to come together?
So, yeah, so basically, you know, I was going to state and I wanted to play music still, you know, I need my little outlet for that. So I found an ad in the Reader, and so I went and kind of I just basically tried out. So when I met those guys, it was just Mike Summers, Frank Melendez, and there was a drummer. I can't remember the drummer's name. He was just, and they were just jamming, you know. So that's how I initially.
Wow.
And so I tried out, and then we were just jamming for a while. Then we ended up getting a new drummer. The drummer part's funny too, because we were looking for a drummer, and Ernie called, you know. But at that time, when Ernie called, we tried out this other drummer, and we thought he was going to be it. So yeah. I actually was like, "Yo, Ernie," to Ernie, I was like, "Yeah, man, sorry, we actually had found a drummer, you know."
Right.
And I actually threw away his number in the trash, and then, you know, realized that the guy we were jamming with just wasn't really cutting it, you know.
Right.
So I actually dug out that number and called Ernie.
It's weird. It's weird how that usually works out.
Yeah.
Because I've heard other stories from other bands, same thing.
Yeah.
I even think I just saw that documentary on Alanis Morissette. Like, I guess the bass player, he was an accident. They didn't like want him really because he was more a jazz type
right.
guy. And now he's the bass player for Jane's Addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's just weird how that works out with a lot of bands.
Yep.
Yeah. It's weird though. When you're looking at it going, okay, so this person is totally into it up until a certain age. And at this point, everyone was kind of that age.
Yeah.
You know, when you're late teen into early 20s, that's when a lot of people decide, okay, well, I'm going to go and chase tail or I want to be a musician. So that was kind of the cutting point. And that's what I always had to deal with in the beginning booking Soma was trying to find bands that were going to stick around.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's certain people that were just, they seem like from the womb they were meant to be a musician. They just hadn't found the right people to actually shine.
Yep.
So it's kind of kismet in a way. I still personally have not found those people.
it's always hard to
my
find.
Wife.
Yeah.
It's always hard to find a family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, a band is, you know, it's going to be tight and last forever.
Yeah.
Right.
Everybody's got to get along, and there's so many different personalities. It just doesn't always work out.
Yeah.
But the if you think about it, you know, the idea, okay, so I throw out this phone number. You know, when I throw something out, it's thrown out.
Yeah.
And then, like, especially when it comes to looking through paperwork, and I'll find something. Oh, wow, you know, this could have been, who knows at this point. But so Ernie gets in because you luckily knew where his number was.
Yeah, luckily, it wasn't trash day, you know?
Yeah, see?
So, you know, I actually dug out that number and called him, and then, you know, he came out, and then, you know, that guy's just a beast.
Oh, yeah.
The second he hit, we're like, oh, this guy's the guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, his style for days.
Yeah, he's a machine, dude.
Yeah. Nuts,
so.
So do you remember the first time you played Union Street?
Yes, because that was the dungeon, right?
Yeah.
Was it the dungeon, the first time you guys played?
Yeah, the dungeon.
God, I don't even remember the first show.
Do you remember the year?
Dude, let me see. Not really, because, okay, when I first joined Sprung, we weren't even called Sprung then. We were actually called Love Slug.
Love Slug?
Love Slug. And we actually, one of the first shows we played was the OG Casbah, you know, the one that was the Velvet after?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hallway.
Yeah, and just right, it's actually right across
the street. I wasn't even 21 yet, so I had to sit outside, you know?
I can't
even go inside, you know? It's like, so, and we were called Love Slug then, and then, you know who actually took us under the wings was Psychotic Waltz.
Oh, okay.
Of all bands, you know, they were kind of the ones that got us our first shows and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And kind of took us under, like, you know, helped us out a bit, you know.
That would be what's his name?
Norm McDonald.
Blue Meanie.
Meanie Records.
And Buddy.
Buddy, yeah, he's a singer.
And then because I lived in the same complex as the guitarist in the wheelchair.
Yeah. Oh, and then Dan Rock, the other guitarist, you know, Dan Rock was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was weird when I lived out there. When I started booking shows at SoMa, I was living in Santee.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where that whole thing started for me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, then they, so they were Psychotic Waltz after, right, they were first Auslan.
Auslan, I believe. And then when I met them, they were already Psychotic Waltz.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that would be probably 90?
Yeah, because I think one of our very, so I remember once again, we did a show at that original Casbah under Love Slug, and then I think one of our first shows as Sprung, one of the first was opening for Psychotic Waltz, and I can't remember, it was some place up in El Cajon. It's like a hall kind of thing, and that's like, you know, we came out wearing masks and doing, you know, kind of crazy stuff, you know, and I can't remember what that
was. It a VFW hall?
Yeah, I think it was a VFW hall kind of
thing. Oh, and it was Norman Leggio.
Yeah, Norm Leggio.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of remember that place because that was back in the days where you would still rent out a hall.
Yeah.
And there was a few that were kind of okay with doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the punk rock skinhead thing was still, it had mellowed out a lot by that point.
Mm-hmm. So was this 89 or 90?
I moved, well, I graduated 89. I moved, it had to be, not, I'm going to say around maybe 90.
90.
Yeah, because I moved up here right out of high school and I graduated in 89. So.
Yeah, I moved out here in 90 because of being in the Navy.
Yeah.
Stationed at Miramar. So I was out here in 90. And then I started going to shows at Union around 91.
91. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, the first SoMa gig was in that dungeon. I remember that. And
do you remember what bands?
No, that first one, not really, but one of the maybe second or third time we did it, I remember we played with Face to Face down there.
Okay.
Yeah, Face to Face was in that dungeon. Yep.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had to start everyone down there.
Yeah, no, it was awesome, though. And oh, it was like a big treat, you know, like when you graduated upstairs, that was huge, you know?
Yeah.
But I really, that dungeon was dope. I had so many good
It seems like you guys graduated fairly quick.
You know, what's crazy is I never even got to see a dungeon show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I always saw the main stage stuff, so I never saw a dungeon.
Oh,
I didn't get that experience. Damn it. Pisses me off.
That's like a fire hazard now if you think about it, man.
Because of egress, there was no exits, right?
Yeah.
You had to go back up the stairs.
Yeah,
there was two exits, but no one knew about the second one.
So the one that went out to the street or something?
The crazy thing is there was two entrances to it, but it was in the back. So, you know, the main hallway coming in, the two meat lockers, the one green room, the soundboard's kind of offset a little bit. But behind that, you can go around, and that was another make-out spot or whatever.
Yeah, that little tiny dressing room.
The Stone Temple Pilots shot a video in.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah, they had us jumping around like jumping beans. It was the most, I was so embarrassed. But back behind the soundboard at the far wall was, you can get around, you can come up a back way. And I only knew because I spent literally my entire 20s when that building was there.
Yep.
And I had to clean the place.
Yeah.
And I would even forget about it. But it definitely had a crazy vibe. So coming upstairs, you know, you get into the Thunderdome.
Yeah.
As a video that we were watching earlier, which was, I believe, 91. So you're playing the dungeon, and then we get you upstairs because remember the criteria, you had to bring in a certain amount of people, and you went from me to, okay, now Len's getting involved.
Yeah.
You're done with him. You're
graduating.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Do you remember what first show it was? Or
no.
So you don't know who you played with on the main stage?
Not really.
Or what year?
There's just been so many, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And like back then too, some of the those crazy lineups. You had like Rage, Tool, like Quicksand, all on one bill kind of thing. I remember some shit you can't ever get anymore. You know.
It was Rage and Tool did their. They just got signed.
Those bands were opening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is insane. Thinking about it, you know.
Yeah.
And the scene will never be the same.
No. That was. Lightning in a bottle kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
No YouTube back then, no cell phones, none of that.
Yeah, that's why just coming in here and seeing that, I was like, what the hell? Because that was done on like a video, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how any of my stuff is on videotape primarily. And I have them strategic. I have a videotape player here and upstairs. Mm-hmm. We have a DVD player, but I still haven't figured out how to use that thing yet.
Yeah, you gotta transfer that stuff.
Luckily, I have a 21-year-old, so I just have her do it.
Yeah.
But so the main stage shows, once it started, got up to main stage, gonna hear, what was your favorite show up there? What still is the one that, like, is like, holy crap, I cannot believe I played this show?
Well, I mean, like I said, I can't quite remember who we were playing with, but I remember that first time just being up there, graduating up there, and, like, playing in the big room, like you said, Thunderdome, and mm-hmm. it's just packed, you know? Yeah. That's kind of like, whoa, going from dungeon. It's kind of a big jump, you know?
Oh,
like,
yeah. Really. 150 people, maybe to 1,000.
Yeah. So.
And surrounded.
Yeah, and so it was kind of like, it was very trippy, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, man, once again, my memory's shot for a lot of that stuff, you know, but it was just...
Well, it just is too many things to remember. I mean, especially being in multiple bands and then all the places you've played.
Yeah.
It's and hard to remember certain dates.
Yeah, and especially because we played it so much over there, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That was like second home for us, you know?
Yeah.
So...
Did CD release shows, and I'm trying to think of some of the ones that, like, really stuck out. The main thing that I remember is, you know, whenever we had you guys play, it was like a given that it was just going to be an exceptional show.
Yeah.
So what other bands locally, or, you know, bigger touring bands, were some of the ones that...
Well, back then, because we would play with, you know, like House of Suffering, you know, Unwritten Law, too, because we played with Unwritten Law all the time then, you know, before I was in that band, you know, all those local bands, you know, Psychotic, who else around back then? Neighbor, remember the Neighbors?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, man, all that. It's just awesome.
It's funny to say this now because I'm still racking my brain every time I'm doing any of these podcasts, but there were so many bands in San Diego.
So many.
Well, you guys even played with Bucko 9.
Yeah, Bucko 9.
So
too.
That's, and again, that's the Soma thing where
you mix it up.
You don't have to be a certain style. Everybody's different bands, different styles, which is good because it exposes more people to other sounds.
Yep.
So that's something that a lot of people didn't do. And actually, when I started doing Soma SD, I kind of wanted to keep it to where the bands were. When I started was booking bands, I kind of tried to keep them the same style because I know a lot of people were getting pissed off. We don't want to see those bands, or they wouldn't show up, or a lot of people would leave. But I think back in the early 90s and the late 80s, I think more people were excited to come and see other types
of
music.
Yeah, for sure, because that was the common ground place where you could actually go see a show. And it's kind of before then... You know, like, after a couple of years into the scene, you know, there's, like, cliques of, like, the Casbah bands, Soma bands, you know, everyone.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because, like, Rockin' and all those guys had their kind of...
And they all stuck to the same scene, the same style, and they were always 21 and up.
Yeah.
Soma was always all ages.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we were the daycare. The other places were the drinkers, so...
Yeah. But the amount of bands that played the bars... was completely different. It was clicky.
Yeah.
Let's call it for what it was.
Yeah, it was clicky.
Well, and not only that, you didn't get the crowd that you would get at Soma, because Soma was much bigger than the Casbah, the Shea, any, you know, Soul Kitchen, whatever, those places. They're way small. And they used to complain about Soma taking their scene or their crowds or whatever. I'm like, no. You know, and even, you know, like you would explain with Lynn saying, no, go play those places. It gives you a chance to kind of get a following and then come over here where there's going to be a bigger crowd.
Yeah. Where your audience can actually see you. And the formula is completely different because, like I've said before, is when I started booking shows, it was just about the scene. I was trying to create a scene.
Right.
So luckily we were able to carry that on for quite a while to bring enough diversity and I would look at everything from the style of music, the personalities, and try not to put something to where you have someone that's going to be complaining from day one.
Right.
If they're like, oh, well, we don't want to play with those fucking bands. Well, then don't play with these fucking bands. I'll get someone else.
Yeah.
But there was so much camaraderie just in building the scene. because we didn't really have one unless you went to the bar. And realistically, if you're in a bar and you're that young, you kind of felt out of place anyways. And it wasn't about trying to establish musicians.
Should we give them a little taste of Pat's playing?
I think, yeah, we need to.
Sprung here?
Oh, yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah. The bass sound. I mean, come on. I'm a bass player as well, yeah. So. Freaking chills.
So what album was this off and what year?
This was That Situation Life in 2004 or 5 maybe? I don't know.
Oh, no, I
had it. Yeah.
It was the 90s.
Wait.
This was from the 90s.
That, well,
95.
I think that's the actual record, though, because we did that as a demo. We had a bleeding demo before we actually... Situation Life was actually the first album, like a full, you know, that wasn't a demo tape. So, and I feel like that was... Oh, I'm sorry. Did I just say 2005?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm
95.
Sorry. Yeah, 90. That's it. Jeez.
It's called Old Age.
Yeah.
A little taste of some Sprung.
I still think of the video when you're looking at the stage and everyone up at the top of the Thunderdome.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone starts bouncing.
Yeah. It was intense back then.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's yeah. I'm still getting chills.
That's so cool. I haven't heard that in a long time.
Do you remember what label this was on?
Our own. I think that...
Yeah, you put it out yourself?
Yeah, it was called Black Cat Dew Records.
Nice.
Oh, okay.
And then the follow-up?
Swirl.
It was Swirl, and who'd you guys get signed to?
That one was on Surf Dog Records, which is Mark Kaplan. He manages, like, Brian's... I think he did Bullet Boys...
Oh, Brian, okay.
I think he still manages like Brian Setzer.
Oh, yeah.
Surf Dog Records. I think he even put out like an album from Jason Newsted, like after
he left Metallica.
Yeah, Echo Brain or something like
that. Yeah, yeah.
I feel like he had something to do with that too. But
so, how many albums did you do with Sprung?
I did Situation Life, Swirl, 2.
Okay.
2. Yeah.
I mean, so we're just going to jump right in. What made you leave?
What? Oh, you know what it was? Okay, I was actually married back then, you know? And I think what happened was I got a divorce, and I just kind of was like, I want to get out of San Diego.
Right.
Kind of thing. So I quit that, and then I ended up moving to San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was just like, F this town, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of like... So, I moved to San Francisco, and this is where things kind of takes that next road, you know, because I moved up there. I was working at a record store called Streetlight Records up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow I get this phone call at work, and it's my friend. It was actually Scott Russo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he called me. So he got my number through a mutual friend, Jen Zip.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So she... gave him my number because they were looking for a bass player. So he actually called me and was like, hey, would you be interested in like trying out, you know? And
yeah,
and it's funny because I had just moved to San Francisco, you know, it's like maybe less than a year, you know.
Oh, okay.
And then,
but enough time to get settled in San Francisco.
I was doing my thing there, and then
because they just recorded the Black Album.
They recorded the Black Album. It was already done. Yeah,
John Bell didn't want a tour, right? Is that what?
Well, the thing, the Black Album, John Bell didn't even record on the Black Album. They got Micah from Pivot.
Pivot, that's right.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So Steve was, yeah.
Okay. Steve
was,
yeah.
Rob was talking about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So he called me up, and at first I was like, look, we always played with Unwritten Law, you know, when I was in Sprung. Always been cool, you know.
Yeah.
But Unwritten Law, honestly, was not, it wasn't what I wanted to play. I wanted to play more harder and more. I'm heavier. I like metal and stuff.
So. Yeah. Heavy punk.
Yeah. Like, you know, I want to do some like metal punk kind of stuff, you know, thrash stuff. And so I was kind of like, I'm not sure. He's all like, well, we just record this album. Let me just send it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was like, okay, no problem. I get it. And the second I pressed play, I was like, they just went to another level, you know, from what was Blue Room to that was such a huge jump. And I was like, I listened to the whole album like twice all the way through because I was hooked. I was like,
wow,
this album is fucking good.
That's awesome.
You know?
Like, yeah, a lot of the songs on there were really good.
Dude, that's a solid album. Yeah, to this day, that's my favorite one, and I'm not even playing on it, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, so that's, after I heard it, I was like, holy shit, they actually took it to another level.
You know? Yeah.
And so instantly I was like, yep, I'll do it.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
Yeah, so I flew down and tried out and made it, and then packed my shit and came back, you know, and that's how it all kind of went from there, you know. And then it was just like accelerated mode because those guys had already been like signed to Sony, and now they're on Interscope, you know. I mean, even when I was in it, we went to Lava. That band's crazy because I think pretty much been on practically almost every major label. Who gets a chance like that, you know?
Yeah.
Epic to Interscope to Atlantic, you know. It's just like, what?
Yeah, that's really unheard of.
Yeah,
really
unheard of.
Especially for someone
with a different label every time you put something out.
Yeah.
That's just, yeah, that's unheard of. Usually you're locked into like a 5-record deal or something with one label. Yeah.
And if you don't make it on the major, you're back down to independent, you know, doing. But yeah, man.
Yeah, they shelf you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and usually with the reputation of being
tax write off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But man, we kept getting.
So they kept it DIY in a sense, but by utilizing the bigger labels to get the music out.
Yeah, we kept getting these second chances, third chances, you know.
Yeah, and then it's like when we did the podcast with Rob, he forgot a lot of stuff. Like I mentioned, yeah, you guys did the Teenage Suicide video at Metro. It was open. I mean, it wasn't during a show. It was during the day. I was there, and Bill Silva paid me to be there to have it open for you guys, and you guys were like performing on the stage, and
damn, I don't remember
Scott's brother was there. He was in the video.
Yeah, he's in the video knocking over a hot dog off.
And then Rob didn't remember them that you guys shot that there.
I don't remember that either.
That's weird. And I had to send Rob pictures of it because I took pictures when you guys were on the stage. There's a couple people in the crowd, but it wasn't like a regular show.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it was during the day, and it was only. You guys were there maybe 4 or 5 hours. So,
wow,
and that was, wasn't that Taylor Steele that did that?
Taylor Steele did that video, I believe. Yeah. He also did Kelly Sky, I think, you know.
And then I had to bring up to Rob, too. He forgot. I'm like, I'm in your holiday video, breakdancing.
Yes, you are. I know that for sure. That's funny. Rob is actually, my memory is shot, but he's usually really good with remembering all that stuff. That's funny. He forgot some of that.
Yeah, he forgot a lot of stuff.
He knows all the clubs we played at. I'm like, people would be like, you remember that club there? I'm like, no, until I go there and see it. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, this place, you know?
Yeah.
See, we've been trying to get somebody from the Reader to get us all the like, from the ads for the shows that were coming up, like, all the way from the Union days and Metro, so we could go back and actually find out the year and the dates, and then who was on the shows with anybody that was on the main stage or whatever, even the side stage shows, that we would have a little more history, and nobody's been able to come up with it. So.
And like when you look at those old flyers and shit, like I've seen some of the old ones, and like especially like those New Year's Eve shows, remember?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But seeing like the lineup thing, and it's like Blink, like opening, like being so low, and you know, like I'm in Sprung, and we're like over that, you know, like just how everything,
and that, and that's the way it was with Unwritten Law, was above Blink for a long time, where they would, didn't I think you guys did tours together, right?
Yep,
where they were the openers.
Yeah, I did. I remember doing a tour with 7 Sec. I was in Sprung, and it was 7 Seconds and Blink was opening up the whole thing.
And that's before the 182 was added.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's one of these days we'll get someone from the band to come in, because I've got stories from the crap that I went through booking them in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the most I would say opposition against any band that I booked
was Blink.
Ever was Blink. I mean, like, straight up, what are you, a fucking idiot? Trust me. I see something in these guys. Yeah. And this is from Len.
Yeah.
You know, the Grand Emperor. Oh, no, you don't know what the fuck you're doing. We're still open, aren't we? And then, you know, they just shot.
Yep.
But that being said, two things that I started thinking about is with the bands in the past, when we went in the transition and we did the Scottish Rite Center.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember that one. That was that, with Ghoulspoon.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The Ghoulspoon CD release party, because yeah. Ghoulspoon was another one that was up there. Yep. See, there's, again, when we look at all the talent in this town, everything from Lucy's Fur Coat.
Yeah.
You guys, in prospectively both bands, mm-hmm. you know, not bragging or anything, yeah. Pat. I mean, come on. But, you know, Ghoulspoon, there's so many bands that just, the talent coming out of this town was insane.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane. And to be able to remember them all, because I used, somewhere, it's either up in the closet or in one of the coffins somewhere in the house, I probably still have my books from, because I wrote down everything. I have notes of how many people each band brought in.
Wow.
So when I go and look back to November of 89, because prior to that, Len had done, well, it was kind of a dance club.
Yeah, yeah.
A failing dance club. But so they switched it up. I was brought in as an artist, and then I was like, hey, I know the Ninth and Short-Lived. And
Ninth, yes.
So I was, you know, that's where, if it wasn't for them, I would have never got my foot in the door.
Right.
So my memory is completely shot. There's bands that I see a flyer and I go, who the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Well, I must have booked them because it's, you know, the Dungeon. But if we could have that whole, or if I could find my books, we would have so much information, it would just be mind-blowing, because we were doing every weekend.
Yeah, every single weekend was a rad show. You know, that was, my weekend was going to the Soma, even whether I was playing or not, you know, I was at the Soma.
We're actually trying to get a bunch of people that documented a lot of stuff back then,
mm-hmm.
and we're thinking of putting a book out.
That'd be amazing. Yeah. That'd be super amazing.
Kind of like a coffee table book with all the flyers, a bunch of photos, you know, and the stories from people, like from the podcast type thing. And that's kind of why we're doing it too, to, you know, bring back those memories.
Yeah.
So, cause we're in our 50s, we're forgetting shit.
Yeah.
So, and this is like what helps bring those memories back.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like and now it's already, I'm like, whoa, when you just said the Ninth and Short-Lived, I couldn't even remember when you said what bands, and all of a sudden you said, I'm like, of course, Short-Lived. We did a split 7-inch with Short-Lived, and the Ninth was a huge.
I don't even remember that.
I think it was a Short-Lived.
Is that the Victory Garden one?
No, the something Road or something.
Road to Nowhere.
I think, is that it?
I probably have
it's a 7-inch. I think, yeah,
because, you know, when I started this whole thing, it started with The Cave.
The so, Ninth, right? Yeah, The Cave, yep.
And what's funny is, so I was talking with, Sam, the drummer for Short-Lived, and I had a Short-Lived band. We did one album called Deathiosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking, and he brought up, he goes, remember at The Cave, and freaking Eddie would show up, and Ara had you watch the door, and you wouldn't let him in, and he would ask you for beers and cigarettes, and you were like, oh, no, fuck you. No, Ara doesn't want you in. Fuck you, you know.
And you know what Eddie's talking about, right?
Eddie Vedder.
Oh, shit.
From Pearl Jelly.
That band.
Green Jelly. Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
Wow. Sorry, Eddie. You.
That Eddie.
Yeah. And I have more stories about that, but I don't remember that. I just remember some Eddie guy trying to get in here. I was like, no, you know, make him pay. We don't want him in here.
Wow.
And now he's looking at all of us going.
Did you know he used to work for Bill Silva? He used to do production work.
Eddie Vedder?
He was a runner and stuff, yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Well, before he had his band Bad Radio in San Diego.
Yeah,
and then went up to Seattle.
I never booked them either. Or did I book? I might have. You know what? Now that I think, I might have booked Bad Radio. I don't remember. But so, you know, that's the origin. So finding out, my whole thing is I kept telling Jerry as I'm getting excited about this for a while about talking with you is I like to know people's history and how it all came up. Because I don't remember who I called, who I annoyed the hell out of whenever I called. Hey, this is Jerm from Soma. Is blah, blah, blah there. Can you play the show with, you know, I had my whole speech. I would call up my mom. Hey, Mom, this is Jerm from Soma. You know? And it just, the memories, but the I like the history stuff.
Yeah.
Because I was just, you know, I always had to put on, I still have a beanie. Where is it? It's over there with my little exploited patch on it. That little blue beanie I was on the side of the stage. Yeah. I'd have to meet everyone, check you all in, give you a stamp. And
yeah. Just get bum you out every time because we'd try to over on the guest list. You're like, you motherfucker.
Was it like that for Sprung or just Unwritten Law?
Both.
I was both.
Yeah, huh? Of course. You know, you always pushing it, but, you know, you always cool about it.
Where did, what area did Sprung come out of?
The Summers brothers are from the San Carlos area. Ernie's from El Cajon, so, mm-hmm. You know. That, okay. You know.
Because, yeah, you definitely had your Poway scene.
Well, the Poway scene to me, I had no clue about until I joined Unwritten Law. You know,
That scene was crazy.
That was a crazy scene.
Yeah, I think that was the craziest scene out of any of the areas for San Diego.
The CPK, you know,
and the East County scene, because again, you know, I was out there and short lived had their house in El Cajon, well, apartment in El Cajon, but we all started at Wiener Schnitzel. And Santee. So Chris Fields was there.
Yeah, Chris Fields.
Sam, Jeff, Ray Cam, Dennis, myself. And then I'm trying to think, there was another cat out there, Lenny, that was starting a band that I was going to try out for, but Mind's Eye was out.
They're El Cajon.
Yeah. Or, no, that.
Weren't they? Santee?
The place maybe I went Santee. To was in Santee. I think I either skated there or, you know, and even back then in Santee, punk rocker riding around on a skateboard in 80, that must have been 88, or maybe it was 89, early 89 when I tried out for them. But it was different. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything really about Poway except for Puzzle Box, Psychic Dykes, which Psychic Dykes and Puzzle Box were another two of the original bands. But then there is College Area, you got Struggle.
I remember Struggle.
Struggle was part of that the hardcore scene with Amenity.
Yeah.
Eventually House of Suffering.
But that's the Chula. Yeah, everyone had their site. Like Chula Vista, had Amenity, House of Suffering. All
POD.
POD, all those cats.
That was another. They're another band that you guys play with quite often.
POD, wasn't it Green Box, too? I'm trying to remember.
Mm-hmm. Green Box because of the electrical green boxes.
And then.
Oh, my God. I forgot about them.
What about Daddy Long Legs? Were they?
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. That's another band that really, I think actually they helped us out before Psychotic Waltz.
Oh, really?
We opened up for Daddy Long Legs at the Casbah. Now, you see, now it's coming back.
Yeah.
Love
this
Slug.
Is why
so
we do this. Yeah.
It's actually Daddy Long Legs are the ones that helped us first. Bad. And then
Damien.
Sticks, you know? Yeah, for sure.
It's just funny, and you start throwing names out.
Yeah, I'm like, Daddy, now it's like all these bands are coming now. You're saying like Dance Macabre. Remember?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Big Mike. Yeah. Yeah, Big Mike.
I still see Mike every now and again. He's riding bikes and.
Dude, I just heard there was a rumor two years ago.
I put that out because one of the kids that worked
said he died.
One of the kids that worked for Metro, one of the cleanup kids who was like 16, 15 back then. He told me that. He OD'd.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm like, damn, really? And, Mike was like straight edge for a long time.
Yeah.
And because he did have a bad falling out with a marriage, and he kind of went downhill from that.
Right. Yeah.
So.
But he's got, I seen him. I rode by. He was down at the bike shop down there. And I come hauling ass by because I'd seen the picture. Of his ink, and he's wearing, you know, the tank top.
That's the one picture with Brad took.
Yeah, with Brad. So I'm skating down, freaking hauling ass, and I look over and I see this guy, and, you know, short, stocky, like, you know.
He was big.
Freaking brick house, you know. I see him, what the, and he yells out, Jerm! What the fuck? I'm like a little kid, like I'm freaking 18 again, freaking my forehead, I run over to him, give him a hug. What's up, man?
Yeah.
And so he's still around. But, yeah, so Dance Macabre, I mean, they played probably less than any band that I ever did there. But they're, you know, seminal San Diego band.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
And wasn't Mike's
presence
in
on
DFA
stage
too?
Yeah, Death from Above. Yeah. Yeah. His presence on stage was fucking incredible.
He had a big voice, you know.
And
they were. I remember Dance Macabre because they were kind of rad looking. They were always black. They were like almost like remind me of Dance. You know, they were always in black and
But kind of like what Danzig, kind of that vibe. But
yeah, it was kind of Danzig.
Mike and his freaking long-ass Viking hair and his voice just, oh,
had a big voice.
But that sort of, you know, again, just shows the diversity of the bands that we had, and we can have them play, you know, with, there's just so many bands that shouldn't have made, like, a good bill back then, and people still try to do it with all these festivals, but back then, it was different because someone that liked...
Yeah, if you think about it, Union Street was the first Coachella.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rage and Tool.
Remember we would have the Summer Slams?
Yes.
And, God, we joked about it being a wrestling thing. I remember talking with Len about it, trying to come up with the name and SummerSlam. That sounds so freaking wrestling. What, people going to jump from that? This isn't Iguanas, you know?
Well, that was going to bring up, too, when you brought up the New Year's Eve shows. How many shows did you...
The New Year's stuff?
Yeah, how many did you play?
Man,
I remember
arena ones. There was like a few.
That's what I'm talking about, the sports arena, so many years Eve shows. Do you remember how many of those
we've done
you
a
played?
Few, especially since I think we, because Sprung, I got to do it with both bands, I believe.
Yeah,
I think so,
My memory serves correct, you know, so definitely a few of those.
Because I think 94 was the first one.
Yeah, you had like No Doubt was on those.
Yeah,
that was 95 to 96. That was my first one that I worked.
God, I don't remember. I did
every New Year's Eve show except for the first one. So when I quit SD, they didn't do any more New Year's Eve shows after that, and I don't know why. Maybe just because of the union stuff with the sports arena and the money. Right.
Yeah,
there's a lot of money. Yeah.
The union guys made it impossible. I mean, for me, those were
horrible for us.
They ended up being...
We worked 24 hours.
24 hour days.
Holy shit.
But I think the first one was
And
only
didn't
like
make a lot of money either.
Oh, no. I didn't make shit.
Yeah.
I didn't. That's why I drank Bud Light, because I couldn't afford Guinness.
And those shows were stressful, you know, trying to get everybody...
Oh, yeah.
On time, make sure everybody was showing up and trying to get people in their areas and the stages.
Well, you got to think about those were pretty big events, and it's just like, it's just you guys, really. know? It's not like you had a big, like Live Nation kind of, you know, a staff.
We didn't have pros.
Yeah, and it's you guys doing all this, but. Booking these, like you're booking sports arena and stuff, you know, putting these shows together.
And then not only that, we were doing 6-band shows as it was, where most venues weren't doing that.
Right.
It was like 3 bands.
Yeah.
But it was, again, I can't stop and emphasize, because it needs to be known that the bands in San Diego at that time made it, even though, you know, I realized at near the end, I got really pissy about everything. But if there wasn't the camaraderie, and the whole respect for the scene, we wouldn't have been able to do anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
So whatever, you know, whatever Jerry and I were able to do with our parts at running the club, it was the bands. And you guys brought in the people. Back then, you guys would promote the hell out of things. People were putting out records.
Yeah.
I mean, actual records and CDs and...
Cassettes.
I mean, think about it.
It wasn't really CDs. They were putting out cassettes.
Yeah.
Nobody was burning CDs.
Because I've never done any vinyl. So personally, I want to do two song vinyl.
It was the sevens and the cassettes. So you had the little 7 inches and the cassette tapes, like maybe the 4-song demo on a cassette tape.
Because it's what I would get, and that's how my collection got so big. I remember at one point I ended up throwing out 4 crates of demo tapes from everyone from Jesus Jones to local stuff, because I had to move from OB. Mm-hmm. I used to live up at the house up there, and I've been at this house for almost 20 years now.
Now those are all worth big money, $75.
Well, it's not only that, it's just, I mean, just so many bands that you'll never hear about anymore. Fishing Rod from down in Chula Vista. Early Sprung Monkey stuff.
Yeah.
So going back to that, where was the first studio that you guys went into to record?
Double Time.
Yeah.
Everyone went to Double Time, El Cajon, you know, all the...
Jeff, right?
Jeff.
Jeff Forrest.
Jeff Forrest, man. Is Double Time still around?
I don't think it is. I haven't heard anybody recording there.
I'm so out of it.
I
wouldn't know. If Jeff was my neighbor, I wouldn't even probably recognize him.
Or did he pass?
I could swear he's still around.
I have no idea.
Let's not kill him off.
Yeah, exactly.
Here, I'm starting rumors again.
Yeah. But yeah, Double Time, you know, everyone recorded there.
Yeah,
you know,
legendary.
So, and after that, though, our first, the Situation Life album, we recorded at Big Fish over in, what is that? What is Big Fish? Like, it's North County somewhere.
Was it Escondido?
I think, nah. Big Fish.
I'm trying to think of who would have that. Do you remember who's running it?
Because Big Fish was God damn, I can't remember who owned the name of the guy who owned it.
Was it someone that also did shows? Because there was a couple cats from up there. It was someone from, I believe, Escondido or Oceanside. Well, JD from Industrial String Jewelry. He was. I believe he was in Puzzle Box. But he, I swear that they had a studio for a while, but there was someone that did a documentary on the Circle Jerks.
Big Fish is out of Santa Fe.
Santa Fe? Where is it? His name is Paul Waroff.
Rancho Santa Fe. I'm sorry.
Rancho Santa Fe. Paul Waroff. Because I remember. So he had a nice house and he had this nice studio that was, you know, built on his property.
Yeah.
That's where we recorded that. Paul Waroff. Yeah.
That's awesome. What year was that? Do you remember?
That was
sometime in the 90s.
Maybe that was Situation Life was 95 or 96.
Okay.
Somewhere around there.
Oh, so that's getting closer to bailing out of town and Unwritten Law days.
Yeah.
Would that be the last album?
Because we did Swirl in Lake Havasu. You know who produced Swirl, which is crazy, is Roy Thomas Baker, who did Queen, Night at the Opera, all those bands like Queen.
How the hell did you get him?
Because Mark Kaplan, Surf Dog Records, was his manager. And he was looking for a project to do because he wasn't doing any, you know, anything at the time.
Queen wasn't around anymore. And Kurt sprung and said, oh, shit, I got to get behind this.
So we ended up, I'm not sure if he really wanted to do it, but, you know, Mark Kaplan was his manager and we were on his, so he kind of just produced this album. And so we went out to Lake Havasu for a few weeks and lived out there on his studio. But it's crazy, like, that guy, man, he's done, you look up Roy Thomas Baker and he's, like, done everything back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's like
Bohemian Rhapsody, come on, man.
Yeah, that's legitimately insane.
Yeah,
to be completely honest.
Yeah,
but that's one of those you actually went there, stay there, stayed the band, there. And
yeah, we recorded there, and he did everything, and then
that's crazy.
Yep,
that's crazy because I've never, you know, I don't really like touring. I don't like being away from that. I prefer to be at the home base and deal with things. That's why I never toured with any bands, until I was doing Since in 77, then when we do little one-offs. But so that being said, tours. What about tours? How many tours?
Let me chime in here real quick. Yeah. Double Time is still around, and Jeff Force is still around. Right. They're still in business, so I don't want to put any rumors out
Well,
there.
I mean, he's legendary, so.
Yeah, everyone recorded there. You know?
Yeah, literally.
Everybody.
Yeah, yeah. I guess Cattle Decapitation just recorded there recently.
What?
So
2021.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So that's awesome.
Still doing it.
Awesome. When you're you know, at the top of your game, I would love to record with them. But, you know, first I got to get a band together. But I think I've got a project, but we're not here. I want to hear about touring.
Touring. Touring was, you know, we did some in Sprung, but, like, once I got into Unwritten Law, that was real deal. Like, you know, I was.
You guys
gone.
Would go out for like 3 to 6 months, right?
Man, we'd be gone for like 9 months out of the year at one point.
And you were doing worldwide.
Damn. Yeah, we pretty much, I mean, all over the U.S. for sure.
Australia.
I've been to Australia like 22 times. You could look at my passport.
No way.
Because we'd hit Australia at least once a year, sometimes twice in a year.
You guys were big there.
Yeah, I have a gold record from Australia.
No way. Congratulations.
So, thanks. I mean, it's by population, though. Like, what, gold here is 500,000? Yep. I think gold in Australia is like 35,000.
Oh, shit.
And so that's, you know.
Would that one ever went platinum, or none of the UL stuff went platinum?
No, none of. I don't even have any like gold record here from here. You know, if you put all the records accumulated, maybe. But you know,
shoot, I thought UL did at least one platinum record.
No, we were always so goddamn close. You know,
yeah.
And it's funny because like, I think about all like the bands we toured with, and if you opened up for Unwritten Law, you were gonna make it. You know, it's like Blink used to open up for Unwritten Law. They blew up. Incubus used to open up for Unwritten Law. They fucking blew up. Like, even like, I remember doing shows where Deftones and Korn opened up when I was in Sprung, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They'd come here and they'd open up for us and shit. You know? It's just.
Yeah. Yeah. Korn would be Korn and the Deftones on the side stage at Metro.
Yep. That. Yeah. And Unwritten Law, once again, who else? Hoobastank, you know, they blew up right after they opened up for us. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, everyone got big, you know. We were even on, like, TRL and shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And like wow. Like you were saying, I brought Tobin over to the house when you guys were writing, and then they blew up.
They blew up, yeah.
I got 4 platinum records and a gold from Papa Roach.
Which is funny, bringing up Papa Roach now, because now it's kind of, like, funny. It's a full circle, because I'm
Tony.
Tony, who took over drums from Wade in Unwritten Law.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Tony Palermo, who played in like Pulley and
10-foot pole.
10-foot pole and all that.
Yeah.
So he, after Wade was gone, he was in the band for a few years, and then he's now the drummer of Papa Roach.
And which is funny because I always bring up to Tony, I go, yeah, you remember the day you were, because he was working at the Troubadour.
Yeah, he was the.
And Papa Roach was, we're playing there when I was touring with them. And it's just weird. Here he's setting stuff up, and now he's in the band.
Now he's in the band, and it's just funny. Like, I just, you know, right before I came here, you know, a week ago, I tattooed Tobin's daughter, because I get a text from Jacoby, because he lives in Sacramento. He's all, hey, it's Tobin's daughter's birthday. I want to get her a tattoo for her birthday present, you know?
Yeah.
So can you get her in? I was like, yeah, I'll come in on my day off for that, of course, you know.
Yeah.
So I just tattooed Tobin's daughter like right before I came here, and you know,
last time I saw her, she was a little girl.
Yeah, and she's like 20,
crazy
20 something now, you know.
I did my stepdaughter's first tattoo on her big toe when she was 17. Yeah, now she's trying to get into it. Yeah. Well, she keeps bringing it up, and I'm like, well, I think I've got 3 machines, and I'm like, yeah, do it. I still have some room, but you know, you can practice on me. My tattoos are crap.
I want to go back to Tony, because you guys are in a cover band.
Yeah. So now Tony and I, he's like one of my best friends.
You guys were always tight.
Yeah, we're super tight. So even after he joined Papa Roach, we're always been tight, because our kids grew up together, you know. And so what happened, too, is funny. So I moved from L.A. to Placerville, where I'm at now, and Tony was living in Pasadena. You know, I was living in Highland Park in L.A., you know. So we were always hanging out then, and then we moved, and they came and visited one time, you know, and then they really liked it. So they sold their house in Pasadena and moved to Placerville. So Tony is, like, literally lives, like, 5 minutes away from me now. So I see him all the time, you know. Now, yeah, we're in that cover band now, and he's playing bass, and I'm on guitar now in that. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, so and he's
Dom,
loving it.
And Dominic is singing.
From Mower Dom.
Freaking Dom.
Yeah, because he's...
he moved up north, too.
Yeah, he lives in Berkeley, because he's going to be, like, some crazy environmental lawyer, you know? He's going to Berkeley right now.
Whoa.
Yeah, and he's I had no idea he was that fucking smart.
Neither did I.
I suspected, because he always had something.
I do environmental compliance right now. So
yeah.
It's weird.
Because I could swear he's another one that as soon as he moved to San Diego from Colorado or whatever, he ended up working with me at SOMA, you know, doing the same thing as, as everyone else, you know, cleaning up. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, we go way back. I mean, back when he would go out of town for whatever, pre-mower days, I would borrow his truck.
Oh,
because
wow.
I didn't, you know, yeah. I was riding my I don't know if you'd remember this, but I was engaged years ago and had Bubba and Judah were her kids.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was a step monster to them, but we ended up not getting married, but I would ride her bike half the time when I was doing Metro. I didn't have a car.
Mm, wow.
So I would walk sometimes. And every intermittently I would get cars, and it wasn't easy. I didn't make shit for
yeah.
me, you know, but yeah, I've known Dom from way back. And then when Jerry had brought that up, I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This again, it's, you know, all the talent just keeps finding each other.
Yeah, well, I've known Dom forever, too. You know, I've actually recorded stuff with Dom before when I was still living in San Diego, you know? And
wow.
But, yeah, that's a new thing, reconnecting with him again, because, you know, he's like, hey, I just moved to Berkeley. I'd love to hang out and do all this. You know, he's only like an hour away, hour and 15, so... When we started this cover band thing, you know, I've always liked Dom's voice. He could sing really well.
Yeah.
So I'm like, hey, you want to do it? And so he's like, hell yeah. So we've already, you know, he comes out once a week. We practice. He'll drive in and, you know, it's awesome.
Yeah, he can sing and scream.
Scream. He's got got a great screaming voice.
Yeah, I booked more at Metro and I booked him at SD.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to.
And they were always good and they always brought in the crowd
they were very good on self-promotion, you know.
Oh yeah,
he and I were working at, I do remember barely, but after I had left Soma, I worked at 7-Eleven with him, so I think there was a time or two that I was putting up his mohawk in the 7-Eleven in the early days of
mower. Yeah,
but yeah, and then the way that band blew up was just incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible.
So here, there's Dom. That's the take cover right now.
Oh, that is awesome. Let me get my glasses on to see this.
I don't see shit without them.
Oh, yeah.
Let's throw a little bit of Unwritten Law with the pad on bass.
That is awesome.
Check this out, Jeff.
Wow.
Where'd you find this? This is not even out on anything. This is like a demo.
Jerry's good at finding this stuff.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. This is on... my bad. I know this song.
Okay. It's the heaviest song on the album. Because that album's pretty mellow.
This is Elva, right?
Yep, yep.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah.
Oh, shit. Sorry about that. I screwed up. Wasn't on. Recording.
Oh.
So we just added it.
So where did you record this album?
This one was done at Miguel, who did Sublime's.
Oh, okay.
Studio. So that was over by kind of Redondo Beach area. It was like right next door. Stall A, I think, was Pennywise's studio. They had a studio. So, and then Miguel had a recording studio.
Oh, wow.
So I remember, it's so funny, we're recording the album and Fletcher walks in, like, just stops the show. Like, we're recording, but you don't say no to Fletcher, you know? So he's all, need you guys to come in and do some gang vocals, you know? So we did on Fuck Authority.
Mm-hmm.
On so we're all gang vocaling on that one. It's just funny.
Nice.
We need you in the studio right now.
stops your recording and makes him record for Pennywise.
Yeah, well, you can say no to Fletcher.
Well, he's 7 foot,
he's a Wookie,
10 tall, and...
But hey, he got dropped at Soma.
Yes, I remember Soma, and I seen him get into it once. What was that? Those shows in PB, there was a, when SRH used to do shows too?
At Canes?
Not Canes. No, it was another. It was another joint. Like was on.
There, I don't remember a venue in PB though.
Oh, it was called, the Denny's is not, down the street.
Not
and
Schooners,
then,
but there was a. He used to book shows at Schooners. There's one.
Was it Dog something or
no?
I can't remember.
Shit.
Because all I remember is Solana Beach, the Belly Up.
Belly Up. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember any. I never went to any shows.
There was some other venue that was down the street from Tang. It's a
yes. It was right by Tang.
So the Denny's is down on the corner, yeah. And then the next block is the beach. And it was just kind of inset because I remember going there. Psychic Zoo guys would be there.
Psychic Zoo.
So I would see like Taz, Norm, One Eye Jack. You know, all the PB,
Clayton.
Yeah.
Well, that was the thing with Soma. You never disrespected the house there.
Yeah. Other places in PB got kind of...
Ground Control never put up with that stuff.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. You guys...
That's like fighting a tank.
You got the big Samoans, man.
Yeah, that was the thing, you know. That was the thing with Fletcher. Yeah. He tried to start some shit, and one of them knocked him out. I think it was Misa that knocked him out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, she was there when Len tried to have Fletcher flatten me. I just told them to fuck off and told them that they were a pain in the ass when they played. And for some reason, I lived. I mean, he looked at me like, what the fuck are you doing?
That's why.
I mean, you know, Len's throwing me under the bus. He goes, Fletcher, Germ doesn't like it when you guys play here. He's, you know, Fletcher, I'm looking up like, yeah, I can't even see the fucking clouds here up there. And so I just, typical me. Full of piss and vinegar, still hungover probably. Yeah, you guys come in here, you disrespect me. You have this fucking asshole yelling at me for shit that you did. And I went out, I ran him the riot act. Mm-hmm. And he let me live.
Because he respected you after that.
Well, I don't think he ever respected me and never will, but I just, you know, I wasn't going to run. Where was I going to run to?
Well, he's not used to people talking to him like that.
No,
He was probably like, whoa.
Yeah. And
not only that, just the ego of the band, being in the band.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were huge, but, you know, there was still, I come from, because I'm older, a little bit older, so I come from the L.A. versus San Diego mm-hmm. crap, and that's what I was fighting against trying to do it, but, you know, Len threw me under the bus with it, and I think Len might have actually paid me an extra $5 or $10 for that night.
Should have gave you $100.
Yeah, I know.
I don't think I rarely got $100 for doing anything. I worked 7 days a week for that guy.
But Pat, you were saying that the last time you thought you seen me was in 2000 at the house when you guys were writing the album. But actually, you saw me several times afterwards because you guys would play Ventura Theater.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You would always come to Ventura.
And I would go hang out with
you
guys.
Right. You would always come out to Ventura.
And then you guys would stay at the Motel 6 off of Seaward there. Yeah. And we'd be out in the parking lot playing CeeLo.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. You would always show up in Ventura.
That's hilarious. Awesome. God, it's probably, I would say for me, it's probably 97-ish.
Metro.
Since I'd seen. Because after that, I really just kind of.
Disappeared.
Yeah. I took my landscaping tools and my 12-pack and hid under a rock.
So I was going to ask him, when did you leave Unwritten Law?
So I can gauge this one because I've been tattooing for 10 years now. So I quit, it's probably been about like 13, 14 years ago. So I quit Unwritten Law, and got into tattooing. So yeah, it's probably about like 13.
I thought you started another band.
During Unwritten Law, I did a little stint in a band called Black President, which is one of my...
Wasn't that with Wade, too?
No, Wade used to be in it.
Oh, okay.
So he was out, and then I came in on, you know, but Black President was like a saving grace for me because at that point, I was pretty not loving being in Unwritten Law anymore, you know, and it was just like the music was getting softer and softer, you know, kind of, and it just...
It wasn't your vibe.
It wasn't my vibe, really, but I was also doing it for a paycheck and, you know, that kind of...
I know there was personality
issues as
well.
Yeah, of course, the personality stuff, but...
Because now there's nobody in that band that was originally in the band.
Wade is still kind of in and out now.
I thought he was just doing Spray Allen now.
Yeah, well, he's... I saw Wade like a month and a half ago in Sacramento because Spray Allen came and he called me up. So I still have a really good relationship with, you know, the other fellas, you know.
Yeah.
But so during that time, I joined a band called Black President for a minute. Yep. And the thing about this one was I would trip out because at the time when I joined, Greg Hedson was in the band. Mm-hmm. So I remember like rehearsals. I'd look to my right and I see Greg Hedson, you know, fucking Circle Jerk religion. You know, that's, he's a legend to me. And I'd just be like giddy, you know, like a little kid looking over. And I'm like, I got to play a couple shows in Black President with him. You know, we played like Alex's Bar, Knitting Factory and stuff until then he kind of took off, you know. But
yeah,
to say that I was in a band with Greg Hedson for as short of a time it was really like, for me, one of my most greatest accomplishments.
And he's not even in Bad Religion anymore.
I know. And the fact that you probably like Black President. It's just a good hardcore punk band, you know?
Oh, really?
And so I got to get that out of my system. I'm doing Unrent a lot, you know, and it's getting softer and softer. But I got to do Black President, and it kind of gave me that, what I needed. It's what I needed at the time.
That heavy kick.
Yeah, I needed that. Otherwise, I was just losing my mind, you know? And then it came time again, like, I had to either make a choice again, you know, because, you know, we had to start recording next Unrent Law album and stuff, and that, once again, that was my paycheck, you know, so I couldn't give all I should have.
Did you get married while you were in Unrent Law, or?
Yes.
And then you started having a family?
Yep. So, yeah, I've been with my wife now for... Oh, it's like 18 years, you know. So I got married during that time, and I got two awesome daughters, you know, Maxine and Scarlett, and that's 13 awesome. And 15. It's crazy, just like that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Congrats on the being in having a family and being married for 18 years. Yeah. I only made it the most. My first marriage lasted 5 years, and my second one lasted a year.
Yeah.
I've never had that kind of luck.
Thanks, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's awesome. So, yeah.
And your daughter's musicians? Your wife play at all? Or?
No, my wife's a hairdresser with no tattoos. And my kids, you know, I didn't want to force anything on them, you know.
Right.
But they have, you know, I got a music room with a plethora of instruments, and, you know, they're not into it.
Yeah.
You
know?
So usually the way it happens, not too many kids follow their parents' footsteps, you know.
Or they, I'm lucky because Monkey, my stepdaughter, is not only extremely talented, she's an illustration artist, she's a talented musician, and she does, as far as like punk rock, you know, I'm so freaking old at this point that it's nothing that she even wants to do, but in her own way, she's independent, strong-willed, and she's got some things going on. She rides a longboard, where her mom and I ride shortboards mainly, and she's just owned that. But all that didn't really start happening until she started getting older, until after high school.
Right.
And she started to really become, but, you know, it's the idea of actually being around long enough to, and with the gap between us, I mean, I'm 53, she's 21. That gap is absolutely insane. I think it's long enough to where she can be an individual, yet kind of look up to me and all the people and all the bands and all that. She doesn't care about. She doesn't get like all giddy over meeting musicians. She's totally independent, which is really great knowing that she's, you know, becoming her own woman.
Yeah.
Aren't you guys also doing like a family vineyard or something?
Yeah, my wife has a wine, Marseillais, you know, winery. And it's her parents have always, they have like 40 acres, you know, and they've always grown grapes, you know, ever since she was a kid. They sell grapes to other wineries, and he makes his own.
Yeah.
And finally, my wife's like, let's make our own, you know, like doing so. And she basically, it's a, you know, it's not a money making thing by any means. It's
more kind of like a hobby.
It's a
passion project,
you know, labor of love, you know, truly. So, and she wanted to have it come to fruition while her dad's still around.
Right.
So she pulled it off, you know. And
that's
so
awesome.
You know, Marcellet Wines is it's she's got like we pick, you know, and it's very it's all family, you know. So it's not like everything's done by us, you know.
So how long have you guys been putting the wine out?
The wine now has been a couple years now, but you know, it's just kind of runs itself right now. You know, there's so many like regulations and stuff with the alcohol thing. So it's mm-hmm. like it's our grapes, but we can't do it on our property, make it. So we pick the grapes, custom crushed at.
So the ATF. Huh?
Yeah, exactly.
It's always some kind of government.
It's so many like rules and regulations. Yep. You can't like. She can only sell it at the moment through the website, you know, and
right.
Yeah.
I want to try it. I love wine.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a snobby about wine.
Well, I'll bring you a couple bottles next time I'm down, you know.
We have to set up something to get some ink.
Yes.
And I'll buy some bottles off you.
Okay.
And pay for some ink.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I would love to have a piece.
Make it worthwhile of your time.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, I come down, you know, every few months, you know. Right now with the pandemics, of course, it's kind of
so
been a while.
You come down here to see friends from back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, like, once again, like the Sprung guys,
yeah.
That's my tribe. You know, I found my tribe when I moved to San Diego. You
right,
know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I found my people. So even though I quit Sprung and was under law, the Sprung guys are still like my, you know, they're my roots.
Do you ever jam with anyone?
Last time I was here, we got together with the Sprung guys and you know, let's just play a bunch of cover songs. We're doing like Dr. No stuff and, you know, just trying to play
my neighborhood.
Yeah.
That's rad.
Yeah.
I have a huge Dr. No, the staff piece. It's horrible.
The cross.
Yeah.
It's big. It's on my inner thigh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's painful.
Yeah.
And I tried doing it myself. Oh, my God.
and you also go to L.A. to see family?
Yes. So what I do now is, like, you know, I'll come down from Placerville maybe every 3-4 months, you know, do a pit stop. I'll drive to L.A., pit stop there, get all my drawings and stuff ready for the week. I'll drive in on a Monday and then stay out the whole week and then drive back. You know,
that's cool.
You tattoo out of a shop down here? We can shout
I
out? Or?
So basically, after I quit Unwritten Law, I got into tattooing. And I'm living in Highland Park in LA, right? So, you know, after I quit the band, I was like, man, am I going to become a rock and roll casualty? You know, what am I going to do with myself?
Because, right.
You know, so after I quit, I was like, I knew I wanted to get into art, you know?
Yeah.
So I was. Like, I'm going to go become a graphic designer. So I started taking, you know, Photoshop, Illustrator classes at the college.
Yeah.
And then I realized that's not for me either. I'm an old school Kinko's cut and paste punk rock flyer dude, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like...
Jerry.
Yeah, you know, but like trying to keep up with these young kids and like you have to be on this... Yeah. You get the latest updates, all that. I'm like, I don't even know what... It's
a lot of work just keeping up.
Yeah, keeping up to date
the
with
terms
the
and
the all technology.
All digital, everything's
yeah,
digital.
Yeah, and then
now.
Like they always change something when the new updates. And it's like, man, that's not for me. And then one of my really good friends, Glenn Sluter, from up here, he was a tattoo artist, but I found out he was opening up his own shop. So I was all like, fuck, you know. I hit him up, and he was all like, look, I get your situation. I'm already 40 at this time. You know? I'm starting to tattoo at 40. That's late in the game.
You're starting over, basically.
Yeah, starting my life over. And he's all like, and I'm living in L.A. And who's going to, you know, I can't get an apprentice. Who wants to give a 40-year-old dude an apprenticeship, you know?
Right.
So he's all like, look, you give me 3 days a week, I'll teach you how to tattoo.
Nice.
So I would drop my kids off at school on a Tuesday morning. And then drive straight to San Francisco and Tuesday through Thursday. And I would couch surf. You know, I stayed with Will Chuck from Sprung Monkey, you know, lived, or Mike's, you know, I couch surf 3 days a week, you know. And then after I was done on Thursday, I'd drive back home, you know, and just repeat that process.
Wow.
And I did that for 3 years. And the funny thing is, like, I quit. A lot of thing with quitting Unwritten Law was minus, like, the, you know, the drama in there, but was I didn't want to be on tour either anymore because I had kids.
Yeah, you had a family.
Yeah, and it was like we didn't really have Skype and all that video phone thing back then either, you know? So
yeah,
it was...
Yeah, for those of you that don't know, touring life is not all that it's cracked up to be.
No, man. So it was rough. So
bus life.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't like being away from the kids like that. So I, you know, I came back. But like, it was funny. I'm learning how to tattoo, but I kept that. I was still gone half the week, you know?
Yeah.
But so I did that. After a year, you know, I kind of got my, you know, figured everything out, you know.
Yeah, you got comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but like at the same time, he's also like my good friend, and I didn't want to be like, hey, thanks for teaching me how to tattoo. I'm out of here. So I stuck around for an extra 2 years to, you know, just
to help the business.
Help the business out, you know. And then finally I was like, man, I can't do this commute anymore, you know.
Yeah.
He's like, I can't believe he stuck around this long anyhow, you know.
Yeah. Well, so, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so I still come here. Mm. When I come here, I go to his shop still.
Oh,
it's
that's
called
cool.
Adora Tattoo by La Mesa. So I go there and just kind of, I'm still, you know, do that.
So. The guest spot.
So how's the shop in Placerville?
It's awesome. I work at a joint called Hangman Tattoo, and it's awesome. Like, the crew's great, and... And it's awesome because I'm living in a little small, you know, country town, you know.
Yeah.
Like a little gold.
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, so how's business?
Yeah.
That
so
town?
The thing is, where I live, there's three shops, but like we're the main shop there, you know. And so we don't have to deal with like city tattoo shops where you have three shops on one block.
Right.
You know, you come to San Diego, there's hundreds of tattoo shops.
Oh, yeah. You throw a rock and you're going to bounce off one and hit seven others.
Where I'm at, that's not the case. So
right.
I'm busy. I'm very
that's
busy
good.
So are you doing custom work or is it flash art or...
No, now,
mix?
Like, you know, I got my own clientele stuff.
Yeah. Does, yeah, you haven't seen his stuff. You got to go look at his
page.
Yeah,
you can follow me on, you can follow me at PK underscore tattooer.
He does he does a lot of custom stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, I got to look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of like Halloween stuff a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but no, I love tattoos. I've never stopped loving tattoos. The one thing I hate doing is getting it all set up. By the time I get my machine set up and get my area and try to think of, okay, well, I'm just going to do this. I start getting into it. And I just get bored because I don't want to tattoo myself anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not that good anyways, but it's just something, you know, like because all these skateboards that are up here, the majority of them are mine and I hand paint them.
Yeah.
So I like doing that, but I don't do like the big canvases anymore and all that. I've got so many other projects going on.
Right.
And when I get tattooed, for me, it's therapeutic.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally... Like, when my wife was like, you need to clean up your mohawk. So I sat on the porch, and that's why the hair's all. And she shaved my head, and I started falling asleep. And it's meditative. Just to, you know, even getting my head shaved or getting a tattoo, especially getting a tattoo, I just...
Yeah.
Oh, it's so nice.
I feel super lucky to be able to do this, fall into something that I really have a love and passion for. It's like going from music... Having a career in music and now tattooing is—it's like winning the lotto, dude.
Well, you stayed in the art
yeah,
world,
that,
so
and
yeah.
I truly
creativity.
Love tattooing. You know everything
that's
about
awesome.
It. You know, and so it's not like work for me, to be honest with you. You know, my days go quick,
right?
You know,
yeah. When you love something, it does go by faster.
Yeah.
You're not like you don't feel like a slave to you know the
and,
almighty dollar.
Yeah,
so.
And it's a knack that I
and that's a key for most people. If you want to live a good life, find something
you love
that you love, and then you can make money off of.
Yeah,
yeah, so. And so I'm very lucky. I love what I do, and I feel I'm good at it too. So you know, once
and again, you're still doing music, so
yeah,
you got them both.
Yeah,
now, looking forward to you guys. To play, when are you guys going to come to L.A. or Diego?
Well,
when are you guys going to play?
Like I said, we're just doing cover stuff, so it's really...
But that's cool.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's super fun.
There's a lot of bands out there doing that stuff.
No
so.
Pressure, you know, and because I always said, like, if I'm going to play music again, it's going to be for fun. Like,
right.
I want to really enjoy it. You
You've
know,
already done it as a job, so now you deserve...
Yeah. Especially, like I said, when I was doing that Black President thing, that really made me love playing again.
Yeah.
You know, like, it was... what I wanted to play, and it was, I loved everything about it, and
that's awesome.
I think, gave me that couple extra years more to be in Unwritten Law, you know, to tolerate it. And,
right.
You know?
And when are you heading back to Placerville?
Tomorrow morning. So after this, I'm going to shoot to L.A. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go pick up my aunt tomorrow and take her back to Placerville because my cousin lives up there. And she splits the time between Sacramento and her son's.
And it's kinda, that's cool that you're going to have somebody to drive back up with, too. Because how many hours is that?
7 hours.
Yep. Yeah. I'm heading to, I'll be in Napa on Tuesday.
You are?
Yep.
What are you doing?
Environmental compliance. We got a gas station that's being built. I got to go make sure the tanks, the fuel levels are there and kind of inspect the site and then take pictures of the progress to send back to the bosses.
Oh, cool.
So I'm kind of all over the state with what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if I drive out to El Cajon, or I do have an account, I have two accounts in Santee, so that's about the furthest that I drive. Mm. And that's with my mower and line trimmer.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of traveling that both of you guys are doing just makes me exhausted because I can't drive that much anymore. But it was like the same thing when I was younger, and I was forced to get a car and get my license so I could do the Flyder route. Mm-hmm. So my main route was from the beach out to El Cajon to go to Blue Meanies, hit up all the music trayers.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I was doing that Flyder route while Len did the coastline, you know, the pretty stuff. But, God, I ended up doing that, you know, 2-3 times a week, and that was, we figured both of our routes were about 100 miles each. Yeah, so at this point, I mean, the idea of thinking about driving from here to L.A. to me is like, nah, let's go have someone put a flame under my foot for an hour. I'd rather do that than... That's insane. That's another reason why I would never tour. So getting back to touring, because I'm just so enamored by this, what other countries have you been in from
we've touring? Been... Europe. The only place I never got to go, which I'm bummed, is like Japan, like Asia, you know. And
right,
they went like a year after I quit. They go to Japan finally. I'm like, you mother.
They love the American bands in Japan. Yeah. Like goes off there.
Yeah, that's why I was like, I always wish I could have gone there. But you know, Europe. We didn't. We never went to South America either. But
no, okay.
Everything else, that would have been cool too. But
how about down in Mexico anywhere? Mexico City or
nah. None of that.
Would you go in a bus or doing vans?
We started it in a van, but graduated to the bus. I don't think we would have made it if we had to do it in a van.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the other thing that I'm just...
Every time they play Ventura Theater, they're on a nice tour bus.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it reminds me of Tony from No Doubt when they got big and they had been on the road for just over a year. And I asked him, because he's like, I just want to be on the road, Jeremy. I just want to be on the road. And I just thought... you're insane. But, you know, the band was growing. The record, whatever.
Tragic Kingdom.
Okay, had just came out. So this was around the holidays. And I asked him, I said, so, you know, how's the road treating you? He's like, dude, this fucking sucks. Yeah. Because that's the thing a lot of people think. You know, you're touring all over the place. If you're in a van, it's...
Oh, even worse.
It's just read Black Flag's book. Yeah. In the van, and
everybody's cramped, and the van smells.
Yeah. It sucks.
And that's after showering.
Yeah,
you know. But the thing about it, even when you're in the big bus,
the van always smells.
Yeah, but when you're in the bus, you don't really get much time. You have to do a sound check. You have to do whatever interviews. You don't get to go and see the countries.
True.
You're always kind of working. Well,
remember back in the day in the van, like in the 90s, we didn't have GPS.
No.
We're going off maps, getting lost. I mean, it was just, it was crazy.
Paper maps.
Trying to make it on time.
Thomas Brothers and
stuff breaking down. It was insane.
Yeah.
Well, the thing too... being on the road is kind of tedious from doing that. You work 2 hours out of the day, your sound check and the show.
Right.
The rest of the time is just sitting around.
Being bored,
waiting. You know, if you're in a cool town, then you get to check out the town a little bit, you know, but still you don't have, you know. And that lifestyle is rough, too, because, you know, you do the show, you're partying until, like, 3-4 in the morning, go to bed, pass out in the bus, and you're in those coffins, so it's pitch black in there. I'd wake, you'd have lose what time it is.
Yep.
I crawl out of the bunk at like 1 or 2 in the afternoon, you know, and then you just start. It's just that cycle.
And then trying to get find a shower, you know, clean shower and freshen up.
Yeah.
And
fresh clothes. Fresh socks, underwear.
So many guys I know that tour, and they wear the same stuff every day.
Yeah, you pack all this stuff, and it's just too much of a hassle.
Well, there's no place to store it either.
Yeah.
No, it's either I'm going to have two guitars
There's places you can store it, especially if you're on a tour bus.
Yeah. Well,
and a lot of times these guys would have a trailer on the back of the tour bus.
Yeah.
But it gets funky. You got all those wet, sweaty clothes you have to hang up to dry, but they're hanging all over the bus, and it just...
That's why you had to be like Fugazi, who brought their own dryer with them on tour.
Wow.
They toured in a U-Haul van.
Yeah.
They had a dryer. They'd wash their clothes at the venue in the sink, and they would dry them as they were playing. Their stuff would be drying backstage.
And that's why Henry... One of his greatest stories is why he always wore the dolphin shorts and no shoes.
Or a shirt.
Yeah, because he would be soaked, so he could just switch those shorts out, and he's got clean clothes.
Yeah.
It made sense. I tried doing the shorts and no shoes once playing Metro on the side stage, and it's like, oh, no. If I was more stationary, it'd be fine.
Yeah.
But no, and then I just felt like I was ripping off Hank, so I'm like, oh, my God, I look like a fool. But that being said, with being on the road, were you ever a partier at all? Or
yeah, I mean, we'd finish a ball of Jameson standard every night. You know, our rider was like 2 balls of Jameson, and that thing's gone. So you know, we're all partying, and
that adds to the tensions. And
yeah, of course, you know.
Yeah.
So
see, all these reasons are why I will never tour.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's sheer boredom too, and then you know,
you got to find a band that everybody gets along. There's no personality issues, and it's like I love touring with Buck 09. Everybody gets along.
They're like all homies, and
I had 30 years.
Yeah, well, you know, I just saw Rob the other night. He came out because I was actually supposed to tattoo Steve Morris. But and it ended up his daughter Shiloh got the Rona.
Yeah, and I haven't seen Steve in years.
Yeah,
yeah.
So whenever I'm out here, I do usually see Steve and Rob. You know, Wade every once in a while. Like I said, I saw Wade in Sacramento. He called me up, so I went down and hung out. And
that's awesome.
Awesome time. Yeah,
yeah. It's cool when everybody can hang out.
Yeah,
yeah. It's cool. Like being older now, and like now that it's. I'm not in the band. You know, none of us are in the band, but like now we're all friends.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
There's no business involved.
Yeah, there's no business involved, you know.
And you're not stuck
in
close, confined spaces.
Yeah,
so.
For sure. Absolutely.
Right. And you can be more reflective, too. Mm-hmm. That's the greatest thing about doing this.
Yeah.
Because I guarantee a month from now, I'm going to think, oh, I should have asked Pat that. Oh, this, you know. But when Jerry and I are doing prep for... any of these, I mean, we're talking back and forth, just trying to get scheduling and everything and figure out who we're going to have come in.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes, you know, the brain to start clicking and things start popping up. And it's pretty insane. This town has, again, so much ridiculous talent.
Yeah.
And there's just so many things that...
Or had.
No, you know, there are still, dude, it's always going to be there. I mean, there's this band called, like, my friend manages a band called Take Offense from Chula Vista. You heard those guys?
No, not yet. Fucking, no.
They're madmen. Take
really?
Offense, like, awesome.
We'll have to heavy. Check them out.
Yeah, they're heavy as fuck, tight.
Are they signed or?
I just got a vinyl. They are signed. I don't know what label, but yeah, check them out. These Chula Vista kids, and it's awesome.
I'm going to write that down.
Take Offense. Yeah, you man.
Because there's really not a lot of really good new music. I mean, there's a couple bands I'll listen to, but I don't find a lot of stuff interesting anymore.
True. Yeah.
You know, it's just no originals. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't like it was in the 90s and the 80s. You know, even the 70s. You know, a lot of stuff is. Well, it'd be hard for somebody to come out with something.
Right.
Totally off the wall.
Yeah, totally.
That nobody's seen, so.
But it's there, and it's, and every, you know, it does pop up, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm waiting for that next.
Plus the other thing is, it seems like everybody has a spotlight now with the social media, you know, YouTube.
Yeah.
Anybody can be a band, anybody could do their own solo thing.
Oh, shit, they got like millions of followers. I'm like, who?
I know, it's crazy, huh? They're making money, and it's just insane.
Yeah, for sure. So,
yeah. Well, should we end this podcast? It's patent, or is there anything else that we missed?
I just really appreciate you guys reaching out and
we appreciate you coming out.
Yeah,
here.
It's
been forever, man.
And just like you guys are saying, just talking about this now, all these, I'm gonna drive home same thing, going like, oh my god, you know, all these things are starting
And then you're like, remembering brought stuff. This up.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah, that's what it was with when Rob came in, you know.
And did you have because you also did John too?
Same day actually.
Awesome.
Yep. Yeah, it was it was pretty cool. Just just the studio. I mean,
I like this. This has got a nice.
It's more relaxed. Well,
yeah, it's a. It's.
And the thing is, we were only able to do four people in the studio. We couldn't add the music. I can actually take phone interviews too with this. Yeah. It's weird. We had the this $1 million studio and couldn't do a lot. So
yeah,
here we have this. Yeah. Pretty, you know,
and you don't have like you don't have that time constraint worry about looking at a clock, you know. You
just and then paying, we had to pay, and it's like,
no, this is good,
yeah,
really good, very comfortable.
Well, we appreciate you coming out here,
yeah, man. Thanks, guys. Good seeing you guys.
And it again, it's been seems like 15 years or something since I seen you last,
yeah, a long time. And Germ for sure, like even
the 90s,
so
yeah, it's probably cool. About 97, but again. Pat, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love hearing the stories.
This podcast was recorded at Red Rum Skates. Mixed and mastered by me, Jared. Music provided by Breakacre.